everyone, this is Maya, welcoming you to today's fourth live podcast organized by the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. Join us for virtual gatherings to keep up to date with topics related to Israel and to Jewish law, thought, and identity. Today's episode is titled Religion, State, and Constitutional Law in Israel in the Time of Coronavirus. On Tuesday, we zoomed into Israel's current political context and focused on the impacts of coronavirus on the election process. Today, we'll hear an update on the political situation in Israel and dive into some of the current issues around the complicated relationship between religion and state today. This update comes at a ripe time, as in the past 24 hours, Israel has seen a series of unprecedented events sparking a constitutional crisis in the midst of the coronavirus crisis going on in Israel and around the world. Today, we're lucky to have with us not one, but two experts of constitutional law, Professor Ori Aronson and Professor Roy Pellet. Ori is joining us today from Israel. He's a senior lecturer, associate professor of law at Bar-Ilan University and the deputy director of the Center for Jewish and Democratic Law. He received his LLB from Hebrew University of Jerusalem and his LLM and SJD from Harvard Law School. Ori will be in conversation with Roy Pellet, who we heard from last week. Roy is the current Israel Institute visiting professor at the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies, and a professor of administrative and constitutional law at the Chaim Strike School of Management in Israel.
So this actually continues in a way our discussion from last week, but it's going to add at least two more elements. So last week we said Israel is in the junction of two major crises, the health one that all the world is sharing and a constitutional one. On top of that, I think we can now add a political one. And then we'll go into another interesting aspect, which is one of Ori's fields of expertise, is the religion and constitution aspect of all of this. So a few words about the events of the last 48 hours. And if we seem short of breath, it's not a symptom of coronavirus. It's rather a symptom of the really overwhelming events that unfolded in Israel in the past 2 days. In two spheres, so in the actually last 4 or 5 hours, I think, the whole political picture has gone upside down. Gantz has announced that he's splitting the blue and white party, leaving the 33 seat faction with roughly half of the members of Knesset to join a Netanyahu-led Likud government, which supposedly by the agreement, according to the agreement between him and Netanyahu, the leadership will rotate in a way that Gantz will become prime minister in September 2021. This obviously shatters the hopes of the vast majority, I think, of blue and white supporters and all of the supporters of the other center-left bloc, including the Palestinian-Israeli party, and secures the continuation of Netanyahu's reign, and will also probably, but only maybe want to refer to this, have some impact on the prospects of the expected Supreme Court petition against Netanyahu's service as prime minister while his trial is being conducted in the district court in Jerusalem. So that's in the political side. It now seems, and things change from 1 minute to another, that we're facing yet another Netanyahu-led government to be formed in the very near hours or days. On the constitutional side, we had a serious crisis in the last week. The Speaker of the Knesset, Yuli Edelstein, and I mentioned this last week, actually refused to let the Knesset vote on replacing him and appointing a new speaker. At that point, it seemed that the new speaker would come from the ranks of blue and white, and that was supposed or seen as a move that would strengthen blue and white's position in the negotiation on creating a new government. Edelstein just refused to put this on the agenda of the Knesset to bring a vote to elect a new speaker. Blue and White and some other NGOs petitioned the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ordered on Monday Edelstein to put this on the agenda by Wednesday noon. Edelstein Wednesday morning just announced that he's resigning his position, refusing to fulfill the court's order. But that didn't solve it in itself, because while he announced his resignation, it takes 48 hours for that resignation to come into force. And he refused, while he was still Speaker of the House for these 48 hours, refused to put this on the agenda in spite of a very clear directive from the legal advisor to the Knesset. That brought another round in the Supreme Court, in which the Supreme Court, in a very radical move, used its authority to give to give writs to government officials and ordered the Knesset to hand the authority to convene the plenary to Amir Peretz, leader of Labor, as the most senior member of the Knesset, which was the person who would anyhow be speaker if Edelstein wouldn't have been elected as a Knesset member. So that was supposed to happen today. Peretz was supposed to, or actually did, convene the plenary to elect a new Speaker of the House, just that in the very last hours before the vote, that role moved from who was expected to be elected to Gantz himself, which was elected as Speaker of the House to facilitate the creation of this Netanyahu-Gantz government. This seemed by many as a serious crisis because the Speaker, as I said, refused to follow the Supreme Court's order, and the Supreme Court took this radical step, basically toppling him before his resignation came into force. They were harshly criticized by the right-wing bloc, although this was 12, 14 hours ago and now seems like ancient history. So I want to hand it to you, Ori, and if you could comment, I think, on two different aspects. This political unfolding of events, Netanyahu seemed like he's fighting for survival, and now he seems he'll lead a coalition of 77, 78 members. Is his reign back? You know, is he holding back strong and with no end in sight? And the other question is, how is the Supreme Court coming out of this? The Supreme Court took a step that by many seemed very, very political and one-sided in favor of blue and white.
So first of all, I mean, I agree this these past events emboldened Netanyahu in quite an unexpected way. In some sense, this is still all depends on how the coronavirus crisis develops, to what extent this new government is perceived both by its members, by the party members, and by the public as an emergency government, as more kind of temporary in nature, in which case, if things do recede by summer, we might see another reshuffling of the political landscape. It's one option. Doesn't seem like it fits kind of the character of Gantz, who seems a more kind of conservative person in general, not so much one to seek unnecessary upheavals. I agree with you that the petition against Netanyahu's reign as prime minister, while his indictment is heard in the Jerusalem court, is sure to be submitted shortly to the Supreme Court. And just to add the fact that already a few months ago, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Esther Chayud, already said explicitly in an opinion that she takes this as a fully justiciable question, which means that the Supreme Court will at some point decide on the capacity of Netanyahu to keep holding his post as Prime Minister. To the extent that we're familiar with the law, it doesn't seem likely that the court will tell Netanyahu to actually resign, given the indictment, but that's still out there. That ties into the second point, which about the status of the court, the Supreme Court. The court has a bunch of really complicated, ideologically hot-button cases on the docket now. Much more, say, stressful than the one that had to do with the actions of the Speaker of the Knesset. And it's kind of interesting to track where the court decides, to the extent that it acts at all strategically, which many people expect it would, where the court decides to sort of push through and stand for its own perception of the law, and where it would kind of take a back seat and let politics do their own, which is why kind of the way the court dealt with this past crisis of the past 2 days is quite surprising, because there are bigger issues on sort of on the docket again. Some of them relating to the coronavirus crisis. We have significant petitions about the surveillance measures employed by Shabakh, but security service and the police, trying to track people with corona. We have a big petition against the shutting down of the courts. So most court procedures are now and are on hold by government decree. And obviously we have the ongoing petitions filed already a while ago that should come to fruition at some point, both challenging the constitutionality of the nation state law and of another piece of legislation that has to do with confiscation of land in the West Bank, Palestinian land in the West Bank. All these cases will come to decision at some point in the near, relatively near future, within the next year. At that same time, the court will have to decide about the Netanyahu issue, and it seems reasonable that we'll not be able to sort of pursue all of those topics to the same extent in terms of judicial involvement or activism.
So let me ask you, do you think the fact that we're going to face a somewhat national unity government, you can argue how wide a national unity it is, the court's willingness, so how would the fact that we're facing a national unity government affect the court's willingness to as you said, you know, follow its ideology, compared us we as if we would just have a very narrow white right wing government.
So it's interesting, right? Because this last decision from a couple of days ago, basically put a lot of weight on a very minor majority, right? A minimal majority of 61 Knesset members, and used the fact that 61 Knesset members asked the speaker to put that issue on the agenda to take this quite significant step of saying, well, that supersedes any alternative interpretation of the Knesset rules of procedure. And the fact that there is even such a minimal majority should matter a lot in terms of who gets to decide how to run the Knesset. So it seems that to the extent that it has kind of a translation of political realities into constitutional doctrine, we have some evidence, right, that the size of the majority is not a major factor. Again, in terms of politics, obviously, it's harder for the court to object to the operation of a highly, say, government that enjoys wide support from large swath of the government. Gantz lost now a key ally in Yair Lapid, and it also kind of depends on how strong he's going to go against this new government. He has a strong following himself. Apparently, he will be the head of, I guess, opposition now, Lapid. And depends on how hard
depends
he goes
how many,
against the government.
Members follow him. It's either him or Ayman Odeh.
Right. Yeah. So that could also affect kind of the degree of legitimacy that this government enjoys, and then its effect on the court.
So what you're basically saying is that if it turns out that Ayman Odeh, supported by 15 members, is leader of the opposition, that would actually maybe strengthen Netanyahu, because it's like it's a national unity government vis-a-vis an Arab-led opposition, while as if Yair Lapid is head of opposition, probably supported by Lieberman, which is, as far as we know, also staying in the opposition, then there's maybe more picture of a rift within the Zionist majority in the state of Israel.
Right.
And do you think this can in any way impact Netanyahu's criminal trial?
So first of all,
it's easier being on the asking side. So all these things I don't have an answer
exactly.
to. I'm just tossing it.
Also, as we know, the Netanyahu's trial, which was set to formally begin already last week, was postponed by 2 months by the panel itself, by the judicial panel itself. This is not part of this emergency ordinance published by the Minister of Justice, who basically shut down all non-urgent procedures in courts. The panel itself decided this is too difficult to handle given coronavirus concerns, and postponed the beginning of the trial by 2 months. My prediction right now is that this is not going to happen. It's not going to start even within that 2 month period, and we're probably going to see additional deferrals of the initiation of this trial, which basically means that we're talking here deep into sort of unknown future in terms of Israeli politics, 3-4 years at the least before we get any kind of outcome from the court.
And to the best of our knowledge, let me ask you an informative question, because as we said, this is just all happening in the last few hours. Gantz has withdrawn any demand for connecting Netanyahu's trial with his position as prime minister.
So this is actually an important fact to add. We still haven't seen the full coalition agreement that has been published, it's what we get from the press by now. One thing that Gantz seemed to have insisted on in the negotiation is that his party, which now no one remembers its name, it's called Chosen Israel, Strength for Israel, which again is a party in Israel, will enjoy a veto power over any governmental measures that have to do with the legal system or the judicial system. This is understood as a signal to, say, rule of law supporters in Israel, that kind of the kinds of extreme measures that we saw being floated in the air as finding all kinds of different ways to get Netanyahu off the hook are less likely to succeed. Although we haven't seen any explicit statement to that effect, it's more about the possibility that the power of the Supreme Court will be somehow diminished. A significant shift in parliamentary immunity rules, but we're not likely to see any of those. That said, two things that we might still see. First of all, again, is kind of this ongoing deferral and extension of the trial itself, to the degree that basically it doesn't really interfere with Netanyahu's operation as prime minister. And basically, we already got the willingness of Gantz to sit in a government that has that in the background. Another option, which is again a political issue completely, but not too far, we're going to have a new president to the state of Israel. Now, Ruvi Rivlin, relatively in opposition to Netanyahu. This new coalition might have a lot of impact on who that president is. Basically, the single legal governmental power a president in Israel has is the power of pardon. And you could see a scenario in which the next president will be elected under some degree of implicit or explicit promise to pardon Netanyahu. That doesn't seem to me completely far-fetched. And again, Yuli Edelstein is a name that's been floated in that context, but other people could also be players in such a scenario. But that's just me coming up with ideas. I don't have any sort of evidence to support that prediction.
So let's move into the government's measures to fight coronavirus. Israel has taken a rather extreme, it's positioned itself, there's a spectrum of measures governments are taking, and Israel is closer to the more radical end of that spectrum. Although the outburst of the spread of the virus in Israel is sort of, you shouldn't underestimate it, and it's not mild and it's worsening, but it's nothing close to Italy or France or any of those. Do we see that creating any real opposition among the populace, or are people just living their lives? And again, how do you think that would affect the course that, as you mentioned, are going to deal with many of these measures in the coming days?
So first of all, I mean, this is really Israel is such a crazy place, because you have this contemporaneous combination of these two crises, which makes it for us, a constitutional scholar, it's kind of a difficult time to understand. So is this a case of a constitutional breakdown that we're gonna, at some point, basically what we knew as kind of democratic institutions in Israel would be gone? Or is this just the accidental entanglement of two kinds of events? Right, so the fact that people are not allowed out of the house, for example, just happens also to make it more difficult for them to demonstrate against these threats to the rule of law. Or
although it should be mentioned, it should be mentioned that the emergency regulations themselves have an exception which does allow people out of their home if the purpose is demonstrating. Well, what True. We've seen is that in practice, right. if people go to demonstrate, there are all kinds of obstacles they face with on the ground police activity.
Right. So we have here kind of a familiar from theory, right, kind of a discrepancy between sort of the formal rules, which seem to support the basic tenets
law of democracy. Law and books and law and action, right.
Exactly, yeah. So law and action and kind of the street level bureaucrats were supposed to enforce these rules in conditions that obviously are sort of highly non-optimal from their perspective as well. They don't want to get too close to large groups of people. So the police officers are quite tense, obviously, and we get all these orders from local officers saying, you know, disperse any gathering, regardless of what the purpose is. We had this issue of whether the Knesset could at all operate, right, given that there are 120 members, and that's more than 10, or whatever, all these kinds of questions. And it's kind of difficult to disentangle the, say, good faith health emergency aspects of these measures and the way they're implemented on the field. And kind of the general concern that this is a bad time for democracy to face these kinds of measures, right? Because we have all the other forces that seem to genuinely try to undermine established democratic institutions. That's kind of a general concern. And basically, we really don't know. People are waiting to see when this is over, are we going to go back to normal or not? I'd say perhaps a more deeply concerning element here is the introduction of what I already mentioned, kind of the surveillance mechanisms used by anti-terrorism organizations in Israel to enforce social distancing, notably, apparently, mostly to identify whom known coronavirus infected people were in touch with. And this is apparently a capacity Israel now has. Today, for the first time, this has been on for over a week now, for the first time this came to review before a Knesset committee, because we didn't have Knesset committees until now, so there was a shutdown of parliament for over a week. And suddenly a new piece of information came out that no one knew, that these means are used not only to track the location of people, but apparently sort of just by, I don't know, by normal procedure, their phone record is also recorded. No one really knows why, but apparently that piece of information is also included in now this new database created. And because it was created as an emergency measure, the planning was very sort of very basic, very few say established means of control and or review of these measures. And that's a concern both about this database now being created, but also about this introduction of, say, security-based information gathering methods into the civilian establishment in Israel. And it's quite difficult to predict now whether that might stop and sort of be again relegated to very specific purposes.
Step further into our title of law and religion. So you mentioned if 10 people now want to go to the park to demonstrate, was I heard or was I muted?
No, you're heard.
Okay, sorry. So that is legally allowed, but they are likely to face, you know, some issues from policemen who are not very comfortable with demonstrations now and challenges to public order. At the same time, the government gave a specific exception to groups of 10 people who want to pray outside for religious purposes. And that's not the first exception we've seen that sort of benefits religious purposes in exempting them or people following them from the regulations, studying in the Torah, etc., and starting in yeshivot. And there were also challenges by rabbis at the first stages that said, you know, going on studying is above everything else, and that's what's going to save the state of Israel and the people of Israel, so we need to go on with that regardless of government regulations. How do you think the government is justifying this different status given to religious practices over, you know, just people that want to pursue their sports or habits? And how is the general public looking at this? And how will the courts look at this?
Yeah, actually, it's quite surprising that we haven't seen any sort of discrimination-based petitions yet on those issues, even though that seems to be entertainable by our Supreme Court. But this, again, has kind of a political aspect and a constitutional aspect, I would say. From the reports we get from cabinet, from government ministers involved in these discussions, the political impact of the ultra-Orthodox parties in designing these exemptions is clear and explicit. As you're probably aware, the Minister of Health himself is a ultra-Orthodox man who has professed his allegiance to a religious creed, at least as important to Israeli democratic institutions, but he wasn't alone in that. So we had several ministers arguing explicitly for the necessity of exemptions, basically for their voters. So that's kind of the political aspect of this. But there are two other elements, say one cultural and the other constitutional. The cultural one is the one you mentioned, that at least in the ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel, we did see a very slow pace of kind of accepting social distancing norms. At the beginning, as you said, we had rabbis explicitly saying, you know, this doesn't apply to us and we have to keep praying and keep studying in these closely knit forums and closed rooms. Some information came out that they were basically waiting for government to take more extreme measures, and then they might have had kind of stronger halachic religious legitimation to kind of apply these kind of secular health norms that they wouldn't do on their own, volition. And basically only now the kind of more extreme measures are playing into that possible need by community leaders. So that's an interesting aspect there. The other cultural element is the fact that Passover, as you know, is around the corner, and there are even sort of religious requirements in Passover to congregate in order to read the Haggadah and to tell your sons about the story of the Haggadah and to involve the older generations. What we see here is kind of a kind of different track, very interesting. There are daily new halachic decisions made by groups of rabbis, some more liberal, some less, that are trying to find technological solutions to these issues, including some rabbis allowing for the use of Zoom, video conferencing, or other measures during the Seder, which is obviously a violation of the rules of Day of Sabbatical as Passover. So we see kind of both kind of the extreme conservative reaction and then kind of a liberalization of some of the rules given the extent of the emergency. And just a word about the constitutional aspect, a principled argument for these kinds of exemptions about prayer, about using the mikveh, had to do with the definition of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. And the argument was that, well, if all states are democratic and secular, there's only one state that also defines itself constitutionally as a Jewish state. And hence, there is kind of a good reason, good argument to make that distinction and not others. So here would be kind of the classic discrimination claim would say, well, you know, for these people, it's important to go to pray. For me, it's important to go and exercise or do yoga, whatever. And the principled argument against that would be, well, you know, this is not a yoga and democratic state. This is a Jewish democratic state or whatnot. And therefore, Israel is allowed and perhaps even required, right, to make those exemptions and not others. Obviously, this can also discriminate against members of other religions, right, that might not enjoy all these kinds of rights, and at the same time, basically harm the relevant communities and the general population, right, if these groups keep congregating. What we expect by the early next week, this is just the final point, is a complete quarantine ordinance, in which case apparently even these exemptions will be thrown out. So this might be a short-lived kind of success by the parties.
So that brings me to, I'm gonna conflate two questions into one, and then maybe we can open it up to people to ask their own questions. So do we see this as part of a larger process in which the maybe younger generation among the ultra-Orthodox are looking to distance themselves from the more harsh rabbis and the more harsh orders or more strict way of life, using the state as an excuse, so hanging to state powers to say, well, we have to do this and that, and opting for the state over the rabbis. And from the other side, I'd want to ask, we've seen, you know, in Eretz Nehederet, which is sort of Israel's version of SNL, lots of mocking of the health minister and the whole idea that such a vowed ultra-Orthodox is leading this struggle against the virus. And we saw Haaretz mentioning that many of the people infected are from, have went through synagogues in the past 2 weeks. Is this used by the, you know, elite, liberal, leftist elites to again maybe marginalize the religious groups and sort of use some blame tactics in them impeding Israel's ability to confront this challenge?
So you do hear that kind of talk that if the virus is more or less gets under control in Israel, and then some ultra-Orthodox community that did not comply with the rules will again kind of infect the population, then this might lead to kind of this crazy reaction against these groups and somehow limit their political power, maybe even worse, right? Invoke this kind of, I don't know, some sort of anti-Semitic wave against these communities, and that concern exists, should be taken into account. And it seems like the leaders of those communities are also starting to realize that there is kind of, there might be kind of a long-term impact here to the way they are perceived to handle this crisis within their communities. That's one point. In terms of the health minister, again, maybe also to complement a point I made, I don't know, this is kind of a matter of sensibility, I guess. When I watch these press conferences, it actually warms my heart. It's sort of to see kind of this broad sort of diversity of individuals that can be involved in such a project, basically without relevance to their kind of specific cultural attachments. I too, like many Israelis, am highly critical of the way the health infrastructure has been dealing with this issue, but not because their minister is a Lithuanian ultra-Orthodox person. It seems to be all kinds of organizational issues there. So in that sense, so my understanding would be that it's more about the political power of the Orthodox parties that has affected kind of the way these regulations were made, and not so much the specific identity of the minister in charge of the ministry. He's been working with non-religious and non-Orthodox members of the larger team quite well, it seems. So there is also kind of the optimistic spin on this, that look, actually ultra-Orthodox parties can be involved in the managing of national crises, right, national issues, and not only kind of representing a specific interest group within the community.
I want to thank you, Roy and Ori, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.